Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am right in the middle of technical legal laws that were passed by God or promulgated by God on Mount Sinai. I'm going to do in this audio Exodus chapter 23, verses 1 through 13. We will cover defamation, perjury, bribery, namely bribery of judges, and the Sabbath year. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 22, the last half of the chapter, we talked about sexual sins, laws concerning orphans, usury, and collateral. So now let's begin here in Exodus 23, verses 1 through 3. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute, so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. You should not bear a false report in verse 1. Now this refers to more than being a witness in court, most probably. Bearing a false report in court would be perjury. But this would also include private and public slanders, which happen outside of court, defamation. Slander is a written is an oral defamation. Libel is a written defamation. Of course, false report would include both written or oral. Whispers and innuendo. Innuendo is when you don't exactly tell a falsehood about somebody, but you imply it very strongly. Gossip, even when the gossip is true. Well, I don't know. It says you shall not bear a false report. Gossip can be true, so I guess true gossip in this case would not be included, but false gossip, ooh, that's really bad. You shall not do that. And of course, backbiting. In general, keep your tongue clean. And verse 1 says, do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. Join your hand is NESB's translation. NIV says, help him. Don't help a wicked man. Don't aid and abet him. In other words, to use legal terminology. Don't help him be a malicious witness. Again, that's a perjurer. Or a slanderer, perjurer if it's in court, slanderer or a libeler, a defamer if it's outside of court. You know, that old saw, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words can never hurt me. Oh, yes, they can. That's why we have laws against defamation. So don't be a malicious, don't help somebody else to be a malicious witness. We have other scriptures along those lines. Leviticus 19:16, you shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Deuteronomy 22:13-19, if any man takes a wife and goes into her and then turns against her and charges her with shameful deeds and publicly defames her and says, I took this woman, but when I came near her, I did not find her a virgin. Ooh, that's bad business back then. Then the girl's father and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of the girl's virginity, that would be the bloody sheet, to the elders of the city at the gate. The girl's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man for a wife. But he turned against her, and behold, he has charged her with shameful deeds. The shameful deeds, of course, is being screwing around with other people, not the husband, saying, I did not find your daughter a virgin, but this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity, and they shall spread the garment before the elders of the city. So the elders of that city shall take the man and chastise him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, which is a ton of money, and give it to the girl's father, because he publicly defamed a virgin of Israel. And she shall remain his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. I like that. The guy defames the girl, and then as a punishment, he's got to keep her for his wife. You think, well, my gosh. Well, remember back then, women didn't have any means of support. And this is basically saying you're going to have to support her for the rest of your life, whether you like it or not, because you defamed her. Exodus 20:16, the Ten Commandments, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. I think that's probably referring to perjury in court, but I assume it could easily be also applied to out-of-court defamation, slander, or libel. Now, verse 2 says, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil. The masses is NASB's translation. It sounds like a communist translation. Well, what that means is don't get caught up in mob action. That would be a perfect verse for those today who are out rioting every time you turn around when there's a police shooting, which happens all the time. It used to happen without without riots. $2 billion worth of riots, largest property damage, and there's a lot of people killed too following the racial riots in the year 2020 in America. They're still going on, Portland, Oregon. They're going on right now as I speak in Minnesota. Justice is individual, folks. It's not in masses. You follow a mob, you're going to do evil, usually. We need court systems that are impartial, as we'll see here in verse 3. If the guy did it, if the police guy did something that was criminal, he should be punished for it. If he did something that was not criminal, he should not be punished for it. The court should decide, and the masses, the mobs, should have nothing to do with it. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Oh, that sounds like cancel culture here in America. Where are you listening, Major League Baseball? Are you listening, Delta? Are you listening, Coca-Cola? The cancel mob comes after you and says, oh, you're a racist, and so then you start being a racist yourself and start attacking white people. Like Coca-Cola Company says, there's been too much whiteness amongst our employees, and it's going to stop. There are people following the multitude and depriving people of jobs, depriving people of their right to free speech. You want to do that? You want to get on Twitter in the safety of your basement and act like a fascist and trash people and slander them all you want? You want to do that? Well, the Christian, or in this case, the Hebrew, is not to turn aside and follow the multitude in order to pervert justice. Not supposed to do it. Verse 3, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. Now, this is an interesting verse because usually you think of partiality with the rich man. That's who gets the best lawyers, and that's who is the hardest to convict. You know, you've seen all the movies, I'm sure. Well, here it says, don't be partial to a poor man. Well, why would somebody be partial to a poor man? Well, John Gill suggests this, because it does seem strange. John Gill suggests this, maybe pity. You might feel sorry for him because he's pure, and let's say he stole something. Well, he's poor. He needs the money. No, you're not supposed to be partial to him. You're supposed to treat him just like the rich guy. Stealing is wrong, it's wrong. Or John Gill suggests that you might be partial to a poor man because you want to gain the applause of people. People will say, oh, look at you, you're humanitarian. Virtue signaling, we call it now. Like all these white people that put Black Lives Matter signs in the yard. I was just in a neighborhood in Atlanta. It had 50 plus people on the street. And every other house, Black Lives Matter. The neighborhood was lily white. Lily white. Oh, but I love black people. I'm going to let everybody know it. Instead of treating black people fairly and objectively and with justice, you got to show that you're biased toward black people because we want everybody to know that you are a virtuous person, that you're innocent and you're pure. No, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to treat people with impartial justice. If a poor man is innocent, he's innocent. If he's guilty, he's guilty, regardless of his race, color, creed, national origin, or income status. Now, of course, the converse applies. In just a few verses, we'll see this in Exodus 23, verse 6. The scripture says, you must not deny justice to a person, to a poor person among you in his lawsuit. Ah, you're not supposed to be biased against the poor either, just because he's poor, just because he might have a lawyer that's not as good as the rich person. A judge and a juror, anybody involved in the legal system, is supposed to give justice to a poor person because he's innocent, not because he's poor, not because he's rich. That has nothing to do with it. It's, did he do it or not? Gosh, it's just so refreshing to read this after living in America and listen to everybody just assume that if you're white, you're guilty. If you've got money, you're guilty automatically because of your income, white privilege, white fragility, as if only white people have money. But at any rate, incidental factors should not affect whether somebody's innocent or guilty or not. Their level of income should not affect that. A poor person deserves justice, and a rich person deserves justice. Justice is impartial. That's why you see the pictures of the goddess with the blindfold over her eyes. She's blind to all incidental factors, and she's holding up that balance where the truth is balanced on both sides, and she comes up with justice. Of course, it's hard to, in this veil of tears, it's hard to come up with a perfect justice. We only get rough justice in this life because people are fallen sinners, and we'll never get perfect justice. But that is the ideal, and it's an ideal that we should strive for. We go down to verse 4 and also verse 5 in Exodus 23. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. Now, I can imagine that I would be very tempted if I saw my enemy's ox wandering away and say, "Hoo-hoo, too bad for you. You lost your enemy. I'm not going to steal it," because that would make me a thief, but I'm not going to return it either. I don't have an affirmative duty to do good for my enemy. If he can't keep up with his ox or his donkey, well, that's his problem, not mine. Oh, and his donkey's lying helpless because he stumbled and he can't stand up because he's got that heavy load on him. Well, too bad for the donkey. I didn't load him that way. I didn't make him stumble. I'm just going to keep right on walking. No, that's not the way it works, folks. You're supposed to return the donkey or help the donkey up. Now, this is an example of loving your enemy in the Old Testament. You know, people always say that it's not love in the Old Testament. Well, love is not feelings so much. It's actions. And here you're supposed to do actions for your enemy. So, yes, there's love in the Old Testament. And in this case, it's a special kind of love, love for your enemy. Remember, Jesus says in Matthew 5:44, in fulfillment of the law, "But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." So that's fulfillment of the law. The law says, love your enemies. Here it is, right here. Then here's a similar scripture in the law, Deuteronomy 22:1-4. "You shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen." Now, in this passage, it doesn't say the countryman is your enemy. It could either be a friend or an enemy or a neutral person. It doesn't matter. You're supposed to return lost goods to the person who lost them. Verse 2, Deuteronomy 22, "If your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it. Then you shall restore it to him. Thus you shall do with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with anything lost by your countryman, which he has lost and you have found. You are not allowed to neglect them. You shall not see your countryman's donkey or his ox fallen down on the way and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly help him to raise them up." Now, this provision is very similar to English common law. The finder of lost goods becomes a bailor for the true owner. A bailor is someone who keeps something for the true owner, and a bailor is liable for negligence. He's got to be careful with it. He can't keep it. So that old saw, finders keepers, losers weepers, that's a lie. You got to keep it for the person who lost it. How about this? Possession is 9/10 of the law. Another phony legal maxim. Possession is not 9/10 of the law. You possess something that belongs to somebody else. You don't own 90% of it. You own 0% of it, and you've got to give it back to the true owner. And this is exactly what the law here in Exodus 23, verses 4 and 5, and in Deuteronomy 22, 1 and 4, that's what the law says. Same as our law. Here's an example of a proverb that talks about loving your enemy with actions. Proverbs 25:21. "If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. And if he is thirsty, give him water to drink." It's hard to do, but it's required by the Old Testament law. Now, of course, we're not under the Old Testament law, but Jesus said, love your enemy. He repromulgates the same principle in the law of Christ in the New Testament, which we are under. And Jesus said, love your enemy. We go now to Exodus 23:6-7. "You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty." As we've already said when we were looking at verse 4, that justice was to be blind to the wealth or the poverty of the defendant. It doesn't matter. Verse 4 says, don't give partiality to the poor brother. Verse 6 says, don't pervert the justice due to the needy brother. So either way, it doesn't matter. You've got to be fair. Now, what might cause justice to be perverted when the defendant was poor? Well, the rich might bribe the judges. Now, folks, that is a big problem. The Old Testament law specifically says don't bribe judges. In fact, it's the very next verse, verse 8, which we'll get to in just a minute. And that is always a problem in a judicial system. I remember talking to a man who was thinking about getting his PhD in law in China. It was in Shanghai, and he was, by reputation, the number one lawyer in Shanghai. And so I asked him, I said, man, you have got it made. You're the biggest big shot lawyer in one of the biggest cities in the world. Why in the world would you give that up in order to go into academia? He says, because practicing law in Shanghai, all it is bribing the judge. I take the judge out to eat. I give him this. I give him presents and da da da. And that's all it is bribery. And I thought to myself, oh, jeez. Developing countries always have trouble with this when the judicial system is full of bribes. I like to read English history, and it's just amazing to me. I'm all the way up to the mid-16th century, the time of Queen Elizabeth, and all the way up until then, whenever somebody wanted a court decision in England to be favorable to them, if they were a king, they just bribed the jurors to get rid of the jurors that were fair and put bought jurors in place, and they got the court system to formally give a decree that was obviously unjust, and it happened all the time. Fortunately, as time went on, the court system got less and less corrupt. Bribery is a big, big problem in judicial systems, and nothing worse than to bribe a judge. I mean, I know that here in America, if a judge is caught bribing, the FBI tends to look down on that. They tend to go after these type of corrupt judges who do this sort of stuff. Another way, besides a bribe, that a judge might be biased in favor of the rich litigant in the courts, the judge himself might be rich and thus biased toward someone of his own economic status. Either way, he's got to avoid those biases and give justice. And notice in verse 7, God says, you do this, you kill the innocent or righteous on a false charge, I will not acquit the guilty. That's I, Yahweh, will not acquit the guilty. In other words, there's going to be some direct divine justice given here. This is not talking about a court is not going to acquit the guilty. It's God personally. And that means, ooh, famine, pestilence, maybe God striking you dead. Ooh, perverting justice is a serious business. You know, murder is bad enough, but when you use the courts to murder somebody, oh my gosh, now you've perverted the instrument of justice that protects the innocent and the poor. And there's nothing worse than that. Exodus 23, verse 8. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. I just finished saying how legal systems are really hurt by bribery. A similar law is in Deuteronomy 16:19. You shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. That's pretty obvious. Just don't do it. Don't take a bribe. Exodus 23, verse 9, you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. That word stranger is sort of a strange translation. Actually, the NIV has alien, which is better, I think. You shall not oppress an alien. That means people who are not citizens, who are in the country. That would include proselytes, who are not full citizens, not full Jews, and temporary visitors who are just there visiting, like on a tourist visa, if you will. Two types of proselytes. You got proselytes of righteousness. They are people who are not full Jews, who keep all the Jewish law, in fact, including circumcision, and they just basically become full Jews, but they weren't born that way. And proselytes of the gate are people, usually resident aliens, people in the country on business and such, who are living in Israel. They're not planning to stay there forever, and they're not planning to become full Jewish citizens, but they did keep some of the Old Testament law, the so-called seven laws of Noah. They weren't required to be circumcised. They're called proselytes of the gate, I suspect, because that's where a lot of horse trading went on at the gate as they were doing business as resident aliens. And then, of course, an alien would also include temporary visitors who are just in for short term. Doesn't matter what category of alien you are not to be oppressed by the local native citizens. And I'll tell you, I was an alien for 23 years living in China, and I'll tell you, you feel somewhat naked every now and then. I remember one time my wife and I were on a tour bus in the south of China, and an American spy plane had engine trouble or something and had to ditch in the south of China, near Hainan Island. I forgot exactly where it was, but we were on this tour bus, and we went right by the place where the spy plane was at the same time, and the tour guide points out where the spy plane was, right over this hill. We didn't actually see it, but he said it was behind the hill, and everybody on that bus starts laughing and looking at us, my wife and I, and we just smile back. Whew! I felt a little bit naked there, a little bit helpless, and these kind of things happen all the time, actually. I remember I got caught riding on the back seat of a bicycle of a student by a policeman in Shanghai. And he was letting the student hold it. Blah, 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 blah. And I wasn't understanding anything he said. And I felt a little nervous. I said, oh boy. It's not the same as when you're in your hometown or your home country. So yes, there's feelings of a stranger when you just don't feel as secure. You got to carry a passport everywhere. So anyway, I know the feeling here, and the law says, the Mosaic law says, you Israelites shall not oppress a stranger. Hey, you ought to know you were a stranger yourself. You were an alien yourself when you were in Egypt. You were not citizens of Egypt. In fact, you were slaves in Egypt. So since you know what it felt like, you were not to do it to the proselytes who were in your land. Adam Clark says it was sound policy as well as justice to treat aliens well, because if you do that, the strength of the country will become increased. And that's true. You got a whole bunch of people that don't trust the government or trust the majority culture. Well, then you got problems. But if, on the other hand, you treat aliens well, then the country itself will be strengthened. Also, if you treat the aliens well, this is a chance for aliens to learn about the true God. I mean, if you say, I believe in Yahweh, the one true God, but, you know, you're just a pitiful old alien, we're not going to give you justice in the courts, we're going to cheat you in our commercial transactions. Well, is anybody going to care about Yahweh if you treat them that way? No. We go to Exodus 23, verses 10 through 11. You shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. Now, this is the yearly Sabbath. There's a daily Sabbath. Every 6 days you rest on the seventh day. And now there's a yearly Sabbath. Every 6 years you work, and then on the seventh year you let your land lie fallow. Fallow means it's plowed, but it's not planted. I say it's plowed. I should say it's harvested, I guess, from the sixth year. And then the seventh year just lies there, and you just leave it alone. Now, this yearly Sabbath is mentioned in Leviticus 25, verses 20 through 21. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. Now, what 3 years is the law in Leviticus 25 talking about? Well, the first year would be the year before the fallow year. That would be year six. The second year would be the fallow year, year seven. The third year would be year one of the next cycle, because they had to have food while they were waiting for the crops to grow in year one of the next cycle. So that's 3 years. And God says, hey, I'm going to give you so much crop on that sixth year that you'll have plenty to eat. Now, this is a divine principle. You rest, God will make up for the rest with more abundance. I'll never forget when I was auditing a U.S. history class, and the professor was talking about the steel industry in the early 20th century in America, and the steel companies were working their laborers 7 days a week. And finally, in the teens, I think it was the teens, might have been the 20s, I don't remember, but they finally decided to give the workers a day off. Productivity went up, accidents went down, and the steel companies ended up making more money. Folks, we got to rest. It's in our Constitution. It's the way we're made. And God even put it into nature. Because you let a field rest, and guess what? It grows more crops the next year. Any farmer will know that. You got to rotate your fields. You got to let some of them lay fallow so the fields can rest, so they can recover their nutrients through nature. Now, this idea of the field lying fallow on the seventh year is just an extension of the Sabbath principle. For example, in Deuteronomy 5:12-15, observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, so as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. That's a very familiar verse. I won't read any more there. But this yearly Sabbath is a follow-on to the daily Sabbath that was also provided in the law. Now, notice that during that fallow year, the seventh year, the needy of your people may eat. Well, what do they eat, you might ask? There's nothing planted, so what are they eating? Well, that's volunteer growth, as John Gill points out. If you don't plant crops, crops have a way of casting their seeds out, and then crops just grow on their own. That always happens when you leave a field unharvested. Any farmer will tell you that. So this fallow year has several purposes. One, it's charity for the poor. The landowner did not have exclusive right to the land on the seventh year. Poor people could come on his land and eat volunteer growth, which would help the poor out. A second purpose of this fallow year, it taught dependence on divine provision. In other words, the volunteer growth was from God directly with no human hand involved in it. So that shows that God looks after his people by controlling nature and giving people the bounties of nature. And the third purpose of the Sabbath year, the fallow year, was to give the land rest so it would produce more in year one of the next cycle. Now notice that in verse 11, the needy of the people eat the volunteer growth of the fallow land on the seventh year, but there's enough left over so that the beasts of the fields may eat, which shows that there was plenty of food, so even the beasts could eat food. That shows that the Sabbath principle does not hurt prosperity. In fact, it helps prosperity. The poor people didn't even need all the volunteer crops that were produced because they had enough left over for the beasts to eat. crown that has worked 7 years in a row gets worn out, just like people who work 7 days in a row get worn out. Exodus 23:12. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. Now here the daily Sabbath, or I should say the weekly Sabbath, is repeated. It's already been given in the Ten Commandments, Exodus 28-11. And now here in Exodus 23, it's repeated. Why? Well, Adam Clark speculates that this is so that people would not erroneously think that, hey, since it's the seventh year and we're not working, we're not planning, so the weekly Sabbath comes around, so that Sabbath law is not in effect. The weekly Sabbath is not in effect during the yearly Sabbath year, so we can go fix the sheds and work on the equipment and maybe do some other kind of work. Maybe we can start doing a business on the side. Maybe we can start weaving some clothes, whatever. No, the weekly Sabbath is still in effect during the yearly Sabbath year. I think Clark's speculation is pretty reasonable. Now notice that the purpose of the weekly Sabbath in verse 12, Exodus 23, is so that everybody may refresh themselves. The ox, the donkey, the sojourner, the slave, the male and female slave, everybody can refresh themselves. That's the purpose of the Sabbath, was rest. It is not to go to religious service. All of you Sabbath keepers out there, all you Reformed people out there, covenant theology people who talk about the old covenant and the new covenant are the same covenants in the covenant of grace, different administrations in the covenant of grace, and therefore we have a Sabbath law in the Old Testament, therefore in the New Testament we got to have a Sabbath too. We got to switch it to Sunday. I don't know why you do that. Well, actually I do, but I think it's ridiculous the reasons you give, and you switch it to Sabbath and say, we got to go to church on Sunday. I've always laughed at this. Well, not always. I used to be confused by it. Who works the hardest on Sunday, on the so-called Sunday Sabbath? It's preachers. The very people who are up there telling me that I'm supposed to not watch a ball game on Sunday are the ones, because I'm not supposed to work, I'm supposed to go to church. These are the people who are working the hardest. They're not resting. And then they tell me that the purpose of the Sunday Sabbath was to go to church. No. Now, there are verses in the New Testament that talk about the Lord's Day, and they met on the Lord's Day. There's three such verses, and I understand that. If you wanted to keep the Lord's Day as an example of when you go to church, that's fine, but that's not for the purpose of rest. That's something different. So, the purpose, I don't believe there's any scripture in the Old Testament where the Sabbath mentions worship as an object of the Sabbath. It was rest, refreshment. We go now to Exodus 23, verse 13. Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. Now mentioning the name of another god, that's not idolatry, which has already been prohibited in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. So why add this extra prohibition that you're not even supposed to mention the name of an idolatrous god? Jameson, Foster, and Brown speculate that a familiar use of the names of pagan gods would lessen the horror of idolatry. People would get used to them. I think that's reasonable. But for whatever reason, this verse here, Exodus 23:13, shows the law's extreme concern about idolatry. Why was the law extremely concerned about idolatry? Because the people were constantly falling into it. Can't even mention Baal or Astarte. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the first 13 verses of Exodus 23. This prepares us for our next audio, which will cover verses 14 through 33 of Exodus 23. We will look there at the laws of the Jewish festivals, and we will see that the land becomes promised to the Israelites. The land of the Canaanites becomes the promised land. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoy this one.